This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Parker. I'm Vice President of the Friends of the National Museum of Australia. And it's my pleasure tonight to welcome you to this latest talk in the Curator's Talk series in association with the National Trust of the ACT. Matthew Higgins is the talker tonight, and he's been exploring the Australian high country hiking and on skis for more than 20 years. He's worked professionally as a historian since the early 1980s and was appointed a senior curator at the National Museum of Australia in Canberra in 2004. He's won several awards for his work. His book, Rugged Beyond Imagination, was written while he was a research fellow at the Museum Centre for Historical Research.
Well, thank you very much, Michael and Linda. I'm sure I'm not the only one to say that after that wind this afternoon, I'm glad we're not out in a tent tonight out on the ranges, because I think we've got half of western New South Wales now sitting on Lake Burley Griffin, which is a bit of a worry. Obviously, places further west didn't get the great rain that we got on Monday night. And wasn't it a wonderful relief to get some liquid falling from the sky? It's almost something that we've forgotten about in this part of the world. As Michael mentioned, the book is called Rugged Beyond Imagination. Now, it was to be called, the working title was Mountain Days, Mountain Ways, and that's how this event was advertised, as you'd be aware. But the title of the publication, Rugged Beyond Imagination, Stories from an Australian Mountain Region. And I might just start with a couple of stories of my own. And the first one is one that I told to the walking group the other week as we were driving south, that I think too little is known by the general public about the ACT's mountainous side, that other half, the half beyond the Murrumbidgee River. And then that applies not only within the general populace, but even, unfortunately, with some of our political leaders. And I well remember in 1999 when Tharwa Primary School was celebrating its wonderful centenary, and the then ACT Minister for Education came down to give a speech. And so he was at Tharwa Primary School, the southernmost school in the ACT, just across the Murrumbidgee at the foot of Mount Tennant. And as he started his speech, when he first referred to Tharwa Primary School, he called it Hall Primary School, which, of course, is the most northerly school in the ACT. Now, he didn't do that once or twice or three times, but four times in the course of that speech. It was a very embarrassing effort from someone who should have known better, and I think that says more than anything about the fact that too little is known about the other half of the territory. It's not just the political end of the territory that has a major story to tell us as modern Australians, but it's that other half that has a lot to tell us about the way that people lived, worked and played in our wonderful high country. So that's story number one. Story number two, this phrase, Rugged Beyond Imagination, it's based on a quote which appeared in the Canberra Times in the early 1930s. And although it was written there anonymously, the person who wrote it was Dr. J.H.L. Cumpston, who with his sons had just done this major bushwalk right down the full length of the Cotter River, and he called it rugged almost beyond imagination. Now, Cumpston was the head of the Department of Health, so he had a big interest in the Cotter catchment as a source of our water supply. But he and his sons and their daughters were very keen bushwalkers and skiers, and they played a major part in the outdoors recreational life of the national capital at that time and subsequently in the development of Mount Franklin Chalet. And when I came to Canberra back in 1982, I already had a personal interest in these outdoor activities and started to develop the historical side of that in my time here. And I found out through a colleague that there was a garage sale in Canberra and there were some old timber skis going for sale for $5. So I headed over there straight away, and it turned out that the sale was being run by Helen Cumpston, who was the widow of one of Dr. Cumpston's sons, John Cumpston, who himself was a very well-known Canberran, a former Rat of Tobruk. He has a landform in Antarctica named after him, the Cumpston Massif. So it's a very interesting family. So I bought a pair of these timber skis, and subsequently I met one of John's sisters, Mary Cumpston, and she filled me in on some of the family history and the activities at Mount Franklin Chalet. And by the late 90s, Franklin Chalet was being developed into a ski museum, no longer an active ski chalet. It was a wonderful ski museum telling the story of the oldest club-built ski lodge on the Australian mainland. And that development was being undertaken by the volunteers of the Canberra Alpine Club and the staff of Namajee National Park. And, of course, they needed skis and photos and pieces of clothing and other artefacts to build this museum. So I decided to do the right thing, and I gave these wonderful timber skis plus the cane stocks with their leather baskets to Mount Franklin Chalet, and they were part of that collection. Well, of course, on the 18th of January 2003, the chalet was lost and almost everything inside it was lost as well. And so that smoke that billowed over Canberra, you know, a little part of that was those pair of skis. So, you know, you try to do the right thing, but fate sometimes has other ideas. So that's a negative way of looking at it, but the positive part is that we're still here to tell the story, and this is really part of the reason for writing this book, that despite the fact that so much of the physical fabric of our cultural heritage inexorably does disappear through time, particularly in times of major bushfire, we are still able to tell the story, the stories of an Australian mountain region. So the book and this work that I've been doing, it is a history of the ACT high country, and its main theme is people shaped by the mountain environment just as they shaped it. That's the underwriting thesis, if you like. And I mean, OK, we know that people went grazing out there and went skiing and went brumby running, but this link between the environment, the landscape, the topography, the weather being a determining factor, I don't think that's been brought out enough in the past, and that's what I've pursued. So what do I mean by the ACT high country? Well, the focus of that is Namadgi National Park and Tibbibilla Nature Reserve, which between them account for nearly half the territory of the territory. But also, I don't want to be blinkered by boundaries, because before, say, 1911, it was all part of New South Wales anyway, and it would be a bit silly just to stop at those administrative boundaries of a national park and a nature reserve. So you need to take in the area surrounding, both within the ACT and New South Wales. So the northern end of Kosciuszko National Park also has a big part in this book, as do parts of Brindabella National Park and Bimbury Nature Reserve, Scabby Range Nature Reserve, etc. It is a history of the period following the beginnings of European settlement, but nonetheless the Indigenous heritage and story of the mountains has a strong place. And in fact, I have a section in the introduction called A Surviving Aboriginal Place. Now, that title might be a surprise to some people, because a lot of people still think, well, wasn't Queen Nellie Hamilton the last Indigenous person, just as a lot of people think Murray Jack was the last Indigenous person in the Snowy Mountains? Well, the fact that the Aboriginal flag flies today outside the Namadgi Visitor Centre, the fact that we have Indigenous elders in the community, the fact that Ngunnawal people play a role in the management of Namadgi National Park shows that that older view, that view of the Aboriginal period being a closed chapter, is not really accurate, because despite great dispossession and disease and death, numbers of Aboriginal people survived. Some of them went away to institutions and to reserves, but some stayed on too and worked as stockmen and brumby runners and in the 20th century as dam builders. And so through the book I pick up on some of those little stories to try to show why we have a more significant Indigenous population here today. The main sources for the work have of course been archival, and there have been some great archives around, ranging from private diaries in the National Library through to sources in National Archives and ACT Archives, etc. But of course the oral story, the oral record, is a major part of this work. If you want to find out the story of a hut up in the mountains, you're hardly likely to find a development application on the files of the local council. The stories of these places are up here, they're in people's memories, and we only have a limited opportunity to record those stories and to get them down. And it's particularly important that in rural Australia, and particularly the mountains, that oral story is recorded. And then, of course, there's the physical evidence, going out and looking at the surviving huts and finding these very subtle ruins, just a few tumbled hearthstones in some places, or the survey marks left by the border surveyors back in 1910 to 15, or the Brumby trap yards, etc. But it's also a matter of experiencing the environment too, walking with a pack on your back, understanding what a steep mountain means to walk up and to ski down, to experience the bite of winter and to experience that climate that the people who lived there for so long experienced. But it is the stories primarily which I find engaging, and it's those stories that I've tried to bring to life through the book and to tell the biggest story through that prism of individual experience. The main themes in this ACT high country area are generally those that are found throughout the rest of the Alps, with the exception perhaps of mining. So the main themes are grazing, brumby running, land survey, fire and forestry, scientific investigation, water harvesting and recreation, particularly skiing. So I'd like to spend some time now making some general comments about each of these themes. Firstly, grazing. Mountain country was essentially grazing country. You know, it's not cropping country. It's not the topography or the soil or the climate that allows you to have broad acreages of wheat or whatever. So it's a place where cropping was very minor, mainly on a few properties, just to provide feed for the horses on that property. And it's ironic, therefore, that one of the greatest advances in Australia's development of wheat was done at Lambrig by William Farrer, right on the edge of this mountain region. There he was in his laboratory doing his breeding work, while around him to the west, you know, there was very little scope for putting into application the sorts of results that he was gathering. In the 19th century, this pastoral economy that was developing in the mountains was basically one revolving largely around cattle and horses. There were large flocks of sheep as well, but there were problems with sheep because, for a start, you had a very large dingo population which would even attack young cattle at times. And from the earliest days, it was a war against dingoes. It's a really strong theme that you see in the diaries and the newspapers and the oral record. And you can understand today why the presence of wild dogs in national parks, attacks on sheep, is still such a big issue because it's ingrained. It's a cultural thing. Just as the Brumby running issue is still a cultural thing, and it's in regard to those two issues where park managers have a very difficult job in trying to fulfil their conservation aims while still working with neighbours who are running grazing properties around the edges. The other thing that made sheep difficult in the earlier years was the presence of fluke and other parasites on the high wet pastures, because it wasn't until the early 20th century that drenches, etc., were being developed that could cope with those. And also I think that the ongoing clearing of valley floors also made it possible for sheep to be introduced to areas which were previously cattle only. So it's into the 20th century where sheep start to come into the economy on much greater scale. And so you'll have, for example, a shearing shed being built at Auroral and sheep being introduced at Bobion by the 1950s, which itself is commensurate with the increase in wool prices during the Korean War. So you have a period, you still have cattle being grazed. For example, Gudgeonby remained a cattle property right through until the stock were removed in the 1980s. But you do have these changes with sheep becoming more and more significant and basically taking over in places like the Tidbinbilla Valley. Nonetheless, whether you had cattle or sheep, in the late 19th century, there were very few fences through the mountains, and it was steep timbered country. And so horse skills, riding skills, assumed an importance all their own. You needed to be able to ride well to survive financially on these properties. And that remained true through the 20th century with sheep as well, because if you were grazing sheep, you needed to muster them to drench them every 6 weeks or so. And so this developed a horse culture in the mountains, which is stronger, I think, than many other areas. I mean, it's commensurate with the Northern Territory and North Queensland cattle culture, but it's certainly a major part of the southeast of Australia, arising out of the mountain environment, and I'll talk a bit more about that when we talk about Brumby running. The initial grazing properties through this area we're talking about were huge pastoral runs, squatting runs, basically, which could be as big or bigger than 20,000 acres, or about 8,000 hectares, which itself is about 1.5 times the size of the Tibbinbilla Valley. So these were massive areas, and they weren't only big in space, but they were big in the mind as well. And what do I mean about that? Well, think about this, for example. The perception of space, I think, was very different then to today. As is borne out by this fact, if you wanted to cross this high country we're talking about, say from Queanbeyan across to Kyandra in the late 19th century, if you wanted to walk it would take about 5 days. If you wanted to ride it on horseback, it would take about 2 days. And today, we drive it in 3 hours. So our perception of space and our relationship with space is totally different to what these people knew in their own time. The sense of space started to change when the Free Selection Acts came in, firstly in the 1860s and through other land developments in the 1880s, when smaller settlers started to come in and take up small pockets of land that they were able to get access to. And the lifestyle of some of these people is very revealing. For example, two of the selectors at Tibbinbilla were George Green and George Hatcliffe. And George Green's fiancée, Mary Ann McCaffrey, came out from England to marry him. They got married in Sydney and then travelled down to Tibbinbilla. And when they got there, George Hatcliffe cooked them a celebratory meal, which was lyrebird boiled in a billy. And that, I think, says so much about the people's relationship with the world around them. And, of course, lyrebird was commonly known as pheasant, and you will find Pheasant Creek and Pheasant Hill on present-day maps out there. So that shows how the early name for those native birds was incorporated into the culture and the naming practices. But, of course, free selection, while it enabled people to get a foothold, these people soon realised that you needed bigger blocks to survive. You know, that's why the early pastoralists had such big blocks, because it was not high-quality grazing land. You needed a lot of it to make a go. So you needed to take up other holdings elsewhere. And because it's mountain country and people need shelter, if you're working away from the home property, you needed a hut on that other holding for shelter in this mountain environment. And so you have these huts being built on places away from the home, which are being built for temporary accommodation. And of course, the ultimate conclusion to this sort of practice is the snow leases in northern Kosciuszko and southern Kosciuszko National Park, which people resorted to with their stock to relieve the home property during the summer and take advantage of that other grazing space and opportunity. And this is a relationship across the mountains between what's now the ACT and what's now the northern end of Kosciuszko that's been going on since the 1830s when people like T.A. Murray of Yarralumla first set up the Coolman lease and the Coolamine homestead. And he was followed by others like the De Salises, who had Coolman pastoral lease for several decades, and Frederick Campbell of later of Yarralumla, and various others. So there's a very strong relationship across the mountains, and that's why it's important not to be blinkered by boundaries but to cross those ranges in the book. Home life, I think, on many of these properties remained largely unchanged from when European settlers first went into the mountains through to the mid-20th century. So, for example, transport, it was still very much a horse-driven form of transport through to, say, the 1940s, and even later, right through to the end of grazing as far as stockwork was concerned. I mean, one of my favourite sources, Colin Curtis, talks about one year where he was off his horse for only 9 days in a year. So that shows the amount of riding that they did. Mains electricity didn't get to some of these places until the middle of the 20th century and never got to others at all. So, again, it was a very different lifestyle to that experienced by us in urban Australia, modern urban Australia. And water. Water supply was quite often the local stream. You might have a race, a channel diverting the stream to the hut. There might be a well, but often the water was obtained from the stream itself. The kids would go down with a pair of ubiquitous kerosene tins or a 44-gallon drum mounted on a slide, a big Y-shaped branch towed by a horse, and that was your water supply. Many of these places didn't have a rainwater tank, for example, until, say, the 1940s, 50s. So if you went through that sort of effort to obtain the water, you would be very thrifty in its use, something which we can all remember today. There is a temptation when entering national parks for people to think, well, this is pristine, it's hands-off, it's never been touched. And, of course, we know that's not true because Aboriginal Australians have been living there for thousands of years. But we know, too, that the grazing families, they also had an impact through these valleys, in particular in land clearing. All the major valleys of the ACT high country have experienced some form of land clearing, ring barking, etc. Some of that was at the whim of the graziers. Some of it was driven by government land regulations where you had to improve the property to a certain extent and you had to clear a certain portion of it each year. And it was interesting when interviewing people from Tidbin Villa when I said, which landscape do you prefer, that ring-barked one with all those standing dead grey trees that you knew, or the present-day green regrown one? And invariably people said, we really like today's landscape, but we're not trying to make a living from it anymore. And that's a really significant proviso to keep in mind. There have been a number of local extinctions in Namangi National Park, despite the fact that it's a well-recognised conservation area of high value. For example, rock wallabies disappeared. You know, today they're being bred in a captive breeding program at Tidbin Villa, but they don't occur naturally. Koalas had disappeared to such an extent that in 1939, when a koala enclosure was established at Tidbin Villa, the koalas had to be brought from Victoria. Carpet pythons disappeared from the lower foothills of the area. And I think a really interesting insight into attitudes in the 19th century about wildlife are reflected in a quote from John Gale, the Queanbeyan newspaper editor and coroner who did a number of trips through the mountain, kept a wonderful account and published many articles about his trips, which were a great historical source. But on one of his trips in 1903, he wrote in these terms, "I had a splendid view of a male lyrebird gambolling near to me on a bare rock. He paused in his progress and pirouetted in the exuberance of his joy, bounding with long springy strides, his gorgeous tail trailing train-like behind him. This was the only opportunity I ever had of witnessing the graceful action of this shy bird, undisturbed in his lonely haunts. Things we see when we haven't a gun." A lyrebird's tail in its best plumage would probably have been mine. Now, today we still want to capture and souvenir, but we do it with a camera rather than a firearm. So there's some just some brief statements about the grazing theme. And I'd now like to play for you an extract from one of my oral history interviews, and this is one of my real favourites. It's a story told by Beryl Woods as she was born out at Paddy's River, born in 1910. She became Beryl Fisher, a wonderful woman who sadly is no longer with us. But when you hear this story, I think you'll agree about the need to record these stories while we have the opportunity. And this is Beryl's recollection of when she was about 10 years old, so about 1920, and her first experience of snow.
Oh, it was late in the afternoon, It was in the winter time, and of course Granny had one old cow in the winter time to milk, and her name was Wallflower. So there was a discussion who should go and get her. Mum said, "Beryl, you better go and get her." Now, I didn't want to go and get her because it was cold. And she said, "Well, somebody'd have to go and get her because we'll have no milk tomorrow." So I decided that I should go and get her. So it was late in the afternoon. I had no boots on. And I didn't have the... I only had a little bit of a warm jacket thing. So I had to go in front of this hill, Smith's Hill. And somebody said, "That's the best place to go and look for her." And she's right down in the gully near a dam, poor old thing. So I got her, and she was pretty poor. And I'm hunting her along slowly. And this awful snowstorm came over. And we got to, in those days, they used to burn awful good bit. And there was a great big tree, sort of. And it grew up, and it sort of came up like, you know, sort of the inside was burnt, and it was up like that. And when she got near that, I sort of caught hold of her and held her a bit, and she pulled up, and I got in this tree, and she was right alongside me. And it snowed and snowed and snowed. It got dark. And the moon used to come out and shine as bright as day, and then wait it'd go again, it was as black as ink. Anyhow, all at once it stopped. And I picked up a big sheet of bark, and I scratched all the snow off the old cow, scratched it all down. She must have been very quiet, anyhow. And then I got a little stick and I gave her a hit. And she made off, and I kept right alongside of her, walking alongside of her, holding on to her. And then my feet was freezing because I had no boots on. And as I was coming down the hill, I could hear Mum cooing. And one of my brothers, he was cooing. And Mum had a lantern. And I was that cold, I couldn't hardly sing out. I was freezing. Anyhow, in the finish I sang out, and Mum heard me, and she came up and met me, and Harold, I think it was, he hunted the old cow down and fed her and put her in the yard for the night, and Mum took me home. And she had to carry me in the finish. My feet were that cold. When she got home, I don't know, but first she washed me feet in cold water and then in warm water. Then in cold water and then in warm water. And me hands and me face, she sponged me face. I must have been nearly frozen to death. She warmed the great big blanket and put that round me. And I hadn't had me tea by that time. See, it was that long. Waiting for this snowstorm to go over before I could come out and sort of get moving. Because while the snowstorm was on, it was that dark and black, you couldn't see your hand. But then all at once, when it left and went, the moon used to shine. But anyhow, I'm still here. I didn't...
How old would you have been?
I don't know how old I was.
10 or...
Yeah, 15? Something like that. It was before Dad died.
There's a number of things that you could say about that story. Firstly, I always consider it a wonderful privilege to have had the opportunity to record these stories, and particularly to meet people like Beryl, because she was so lovely, and she just loved to tell that story. She told it with such relish, even though at that age she would have been probably pretty traumatised as well as maybe frostbitten. But the power of recall of many of these people I find quite remarkable, and it's just fantastic that you can get a story like that, and it can live on so that we can all learn from it and experience that journey with her on that dark night. But there's a couple of other more specific things. For example, they used to burn off a good deal. We got into this burnt tree. So a little reference there, which is picked up in other stories too, this reference to burning off. So fire as a land management tool. Aboriginal people had burnt for thousands of years and Europeans continued it in a different way. So fire is a shaper of the landscape just as ringbarking is. And I mean, some people are very strident in saying what the landscape would have looked like before Europeans arrived, but I think you can only really describe it in general terms because this whole question of the impact of fire is still one that we're coming to terms with. She had no boots on. well, why didn't she have any boots on? Well, surely it's a reflection of their economic circumstances, and I think that says a lot too. But also the tone of voice. People didn't burn off, they burned off. The stretching of the vowel O, you find a lot in these stories. Off becomes off, and you don't cross a creek, you cross it. And I think that's wonderful too, and that the nature of oral history enables you to get to the heart of that, and it's something I've tried to bring out in the book. And, of course, translating a spoken story into written form is always a challenge, but I've tried to retain that initial speech and the use of grammar, that particular use of grammar, as much as possible. So that was Beryl Woods, Beryl Fisher, as she was when she was married. So a few comments about Brumby running. Whether you love feral horses or loathe them, whether you agree they should be in national parks or shouldn't, we all have to face the fact that Brumby running has had a particularly colourful place in Australia's folklore. You only have to look at that $10 note in your wallet or purse, and there you will see the face of Banjo Patterson, some lines from The Man from Snowy River, and a depiction of some of those wild horses, one of which is the colt from Old Regret. And, of course, we've had the film and the Silver Brumby series of novels by Aline Mitchell and the film of that as well. So it's been a major part of our bush folklore, especially in the southeast high country. Why? Because it was a place where people had to ride and ride well. Brumby running developed as a sport. And it was a way where you could compete with your fellows and maybe get a horse which you could sell or break in as a saddle horse or a pack horse and use it. And although the Brumby running story in the high country is associated strongly with Kosciuszko in Victoria, the ACT had its share as well. And some very interesting aspects of that story is that the man from Snowy River didn't have it all his own way, because there were very skilled women riders out there as well, numbers of them who worked on these properties, who were out from an early age, you know, working with their fathers and mothers sometimes, and developing those same horse skills, and they liked to get out and ride just as much as the men did. And it's interesting that Miles Franklin, who was born at Talbingo but grew up in the Brindabella Valley, she had family links with some of these leading Brumby runners out here in the Brindabellas, and although I don't think she actually chased Brumbies herself, she certainly went on some of these rides, and she took a little notebook with her. And I think it's those experiences that lead to those wonderful descriptions in some of her key novels, like All That Swagger. Another thing that you get a more accurate view of than is often presented in the media is the sort of clothing that was worn by Brumby runners. If you look at the usual film or TV production, it looks like you couldn't even get on a horse unless you had a dryer bone. Everyone wore a full-length oilskin all the time. Well, of course, people did wear those clothes in when the weather demanded it, but at other times they wore all sorts of clothes, and there's photos that I've gotten, some of which are in the book, where people even wore a coat and necktie, you know, or all sorts of things, or leather leggings, say, after the First World War, wore surplus gear, or why not? So it's a broader and a more interesting and a more richly textured picture that arises from this sort of research than you might get from the average film. And, the full-length oilskin has been used many times, sometimes reasonably well, I think, like in the opening ceremony for the Sydney Olympics, sometimes not so well with the APEC Leaders Conference a couple of years ago, where they were all decked out in multicoloured ones on the steps of the Opera House, and they all looked a bit embarrassed, you know. But I could see that coming. Land survey is another very significant theme, especially the survey of the ACT New South Wales border. Again, the mountain environment was shaping things, because the thing that shapes the ACT is water. The Commonwealth authorities wanted to safeguard the water supply for the new national capital. And so the ACT, by and large, is shaped by a series of water catchments, the most important one of which is the Cotter River. And that's why it's that really weird shape extending so far to the southwest. When I describe the ACT to people, I say it's sort of shaped like a mutant ear, because that's the best thing that I can think of. But it is water and watersheds that have shaped that. It was a significant national survey in terms of the various state and territory surveys that were undertaken, and it was undertaken very well. There were no residual sticking points to argue over, like along the Queensland-New South Wales border or the eastern border of South Australia, with the exception slightly of a part of the Cotter catchment, which was inadvertently cut off by that straight line section in the northwest from Mount Coree to One Tree Hill near Hall, which had to subsequently be dealt with through a land acquisition. But apart from that, it was a job very well done. And this story is a story of three survey parties. Percy Sheaf, after whom Sheaf House at Canberra Grammar is named, and Sheaf Street in Holder. Harry Mowat, Mowat Street in Lynham. And Percy Johnston, a Western Australian. I don't think we've got anything named after him, but he subsequently became a Director General of National Mapping and a Surveyor General. And these people, like the graziers around them, they had to get around by pack horse and on foot because of the ruggedness of the country. But that didn't stop Freddie Johnston, the third surveyor, from buying a Model T Ford. He was a pretty dapper sort of guy, and in 1915 he bought a Model T Ford, and he was going to drive that down to the southern border. And he writes in his memoir, Knights and Theodolites, that when he went out to Queanbeyan to get his driver's licence, the Queanbeyan policeman who rode with him in the car had never been in a vehicle before. And he was absolutely terrified, apparently. But Freddie got his licence and drove down to the border, and there's a wonderful photo in National Archives of the Model T Ford parked in its own tent at his base camp near Westerman's homestead, and there's another tent nearby with a flue coming out of it. That was obviously the kitchen tent, I guess. But once he got to that base camp, he didn't get the Model T beyond because it was just far too rugged. And I think these survey parties too, because they were following ranges, I mean, it might sound easy, you just follow the range, you know, anyone can do that, but anyone who's been out on those ranges knows that you can very easily get misled down a side spur, you know, because you can't see through the timber which way it's going. So the local people, the mountain people who are employed as labourers on these parties, I think would have played a major role in doing a reconnaissance and telling the surveyor which way the ranges went, because these people knew the country. And it's interesting too that the surveyors, they had their own experiences with snow. Harry Mowat got snowed in south of Mount Gingerah in May 1914. And he got a message somehow through Charles Scrivener, the head of surveying down here at Acton, and said, I'm snowed in, you know, can I come in please, sir? And Scrivener said, well, you can stop being up on the border, but I want you to keep surveying the upper reaches of the Cotter River, because we need to know more about the river. So he still spent the rest of that winter in pretty cold circumstances. And two of the surveyors actually had their wives with them, Katie Sheaf. Percy and Katie married during the survey, and she joined him living under canvas as newlyweds amongst the tents of all the other workers. Not much privacy for a newly married couple, especially as Percy's mother was also there for part of the time. And I have met both of the Sheaf's daughters, Jean and Isabel, and Jean used to bring a boyfriend home, and of course Percy, by then retired, would immediately grab the young fellow and start telling him about all his wonderful experiences on the border. And perhaps it's no wonder that poor old Jean never got to get married, because she never had a chance. But, you know, the families have given me wonderful assistance with this, and Althea De Salis has been a very great help through Adrienne Bradley, her daughter, in getting to know the story of Harry Mowat as well. And of course, Harry Mowat's wife, Iris, was also out on the border for some of the time. Fire and forestry, another major theme. In 1939, as we know too well, major bushfires swept through the Victorian Mount Ash Forest. Over 70 people were killed. Separate fires burned in the Snowy Mountains and here in the ACT. And as a result of that, the ACT Bushfire Council was formed, and various fire districts were set up. But also a new settlement was established on the top of the Brindabella Range, Bull's Head. So this was a singular response to fight fire in future, that you'd have a small population of rangers up there who would go about patrolling, who would build fire towers, do burning off, etc. And that was their job, as well as to police the Cotter catchment, which had to be kept clean for its water catchment values. And so these were people like Doug Maxwell and his brother Lack, and Vince Oldfield and Billy Jemmett, mountain people who knew the ranges well and could ride, because that was basically the only way to get around. They built several fire towers, one of which was built into the top of an ancient snow gum at the top of Brindabella Mountain. One of them was built out on Bagg Range, well inside New South Wales, through the cooperation of the New South Wales government. And so it's this threat to Canberra from fires coming from the west, from the forested mountain country, that is, again, shaping the response to it, because people knew then that that's where the worst fires would come from, especially as burning off was going on in an unregulated way on the New South Wales side, down in the Brindabella Valley, for example, sometimes at the very dangerous times of the year, hot, windy weather. And so the ACT Bushfire Council, in fact, got the government to lease from New South Wales a massive area of over 50,000 acres on that western side of the Brindabellas, running down to the Goodra Digby River, so they could control that and control the burning off there to try to have a buffer between the potential threat from New South Wales burning off practices and the territory. And, of course, as we saw in 2003, that's exactly where the worst of those fires come from, because it always comes from the west when those howling westerlies occur. But Bull's Head was the highest and most remote and isolated settlement in the ACT. And ironically, for a settlement established to deal with bushfire, it was winter, which was the hardest time to endure. Many times the people there were snowed in, frozen water pipes, etc., etc. But they had their own fun. They built a tennis court. And you can imagine that on the top of the Brindabella Range, a good, you know, westerly, like today, Who knows where the ball would end up with a good forehand lob? Probably in Monaro Street, Queanbeyan. But nonetheless, it was quite a significant place there. In fact, tonight we have someone who was born when his parents were still living up there. And that in itself says, you know, you can imagine what it's like for a woman in labour to travel by truck down to Canberra Community Hospital in the middle of the night. After the war, the role of Bull's Head changed because Canberra was in need of building timber for post-war development. There was a shortage of timber, so the decision was made to exploit the hardwood forests of the eastern side of the Brindabella Range. And so these are the sorts of timber that you find in mountain country, brown barrel, alpine ash, mountain gum, growing at a certain elevational band with certain within a certain moisture range. So again, it's the mountain environment that's shaping these activities and these industries. The forestry activity, the logging, took place from 1947 to 1962, and during that time, 47 million super feet. Now, that's an old imperial measurement of volume. It's a foot by an inch by an inch. If that means anything to us who still work in those old measurements. And this timber was being brought into Canberra. It was logged out there but brought into the Canberra sawmill at Kingston for sawing up into timber for house building and building construction generally. So many people who live in a Canberra house of that vintage, many of you would have a hardwood frame, and chances are some of that timber is from the Brindabellas initially, as well as other buildings that were built around Canberra at the time. The period also witnessed the change in Australian forestry from the old days of axes and crosscut saws through to chainsaws and mechanised means of getting the logs out through winches and jeeps, etc., and bulldozers coming in to build tracks. So it's a significant period in Australian forestry history as well. Plots and plantings is another chapter of the book, and it's really a discussion of various scientific activities, particularly in the botanic or forestry theme. And one of the most important was an alpine botanic garden established by Lindsay Pryor. Now, Pryor had been a forester out in the Brindabellas, but then in 1944 he became the head of Parks and Gardens in Canberra. It played a major role in the greening of Canberra, the landscaping work which had begun under Weston in the early days, continued on, and Pryor took on that mantle in the 1940s. And he helped to establish the Canberra Botanic Gardens, now the Australian National Botanic Gardens, and he wanted to develop annexes in other climatic areas. So the Jervis Bay Annex down the coast, which is still there flourishing today, many of you have probably been there, and an alpine garden up on Mount Gingera in the Brindabellas for those alpine species and subalpine species, both species which were local to the Brindabellas, but also some really key ones from over on Mount Kosciuszko itself. And he did this work with an Austrian-born botanist, Erwin Gauber, and they started to plant out this plot on Mount Gingera in the Brindabellas. They built a little shelter hut nearby, put some paths around and some bridges over streams, and it had wonderful potential to take people into the high country to teach them about our wonderful high country flora. Unfortunately, the project eventually languished because of competing financial needs and the isolated nature of the site. But the hut still survives today, Pryor's hut, and it's one of the best huts in Namadgee National Park. And in a nicely ironic way, it still fulfils Pryor's dream, because although the garden isn't there, the hut still draws people up into the mountains itself, and through that experience people learn about and regard the high country environment that much more highly. And Pryor himself was ahead of his time in many ways, because since his idea, these sorts of mountain annexes have been built elsewhere, both in Australia and overseas. For example, the Missouri Mountain Annex in the US, the Mount Toma Gardens in the Blue Mountains, and Mount Lofty Gardens in Adelaide. So it was a wonderful effort, a singular one in the Australian Alps, which unfortunately didn't survive. The other side of this forestry science story in the Brindabellas is the Arborita. These were plots which were established to try to find out which species of softwood would do best in an ACT or southern Australian environment, because Australia is very richly endowed with hardwood but very little softwood. And so that's why these plots were set up at various elevations and aspects to trial a range of species from around the world on the slopes of the Brindabellas. About 30 of them. They were measured right through to the 1970s so that the growth rates, etc., could be compared and decisions made about what to plant. And ultimately, of course, Pinus radiata was the supreme species, and that's why we see that in so many of our softwood plantations around the place. By the 1970s, of course, thinking about the presence of exotic trees in mountain country, which was potentially being seen as national park country, those ideas were changing and a number of the arboreta were removed. But nonetheless, a number of them were retained as key examples of these softwoods from around the world. and a number of them were interpreted for the public, like Blundell's Farm Arboretum by the 1980s. Sadly, of course, the bushfires put paid to nearly all of them, and there's only one survivor today, Bandora, and it's well worth a visit to see these trees from around the world. Water and water harvesting. Globally, mountains are significant as a source of fresh water. That's the same in Australia as it is overseas, and it's the same in Canberra, because we would not be here were it not for those mountains to our west and southwest, because simply a mountain environment is a wet environment. It's those mountains which have provided us with the well-watered Cotter catchment, and that simply wouldn't be the water supply for a city of this size, Australia's biggest inland city, were it not for the mountains out there. So the Cotter has been a sure and pure supply, like an umbilical cord between the city and the mountains for all those years, ever since the first dam was begun in 1912, the Cotter Dam. Of course, there are three dams on the Cotter. The Cotter itself, known as a concrete gravity dam, basically it's a big lump of concrete holding the water back by the virtue of its mass. Bandora Dam, halfway up the Cotter, consisting of a thin-walled double curvature arch, so it's curved horizontally and vertically, and it was one of the first dams of that type to be built in Australia. And then Corran, up at the top of the, near the top of the valley, an earthen rock fill dam. So these all have structural and engineering interest. And it's particularly interesting that they were built in parallel with the Snowy Scheme, the Snowy Mountains Hydroelectric Scheme. And a number of the workers who worked on the Snowy Scheme came over and worked on these projects. For example, Tease Brothers, who played such a role in the Snowy, they came over and built Corran. There were drillers and engineers who also assisted. A lot of Snowy expertise helped to build these projects out here. And one of the particularly interesting aspects of the developments on the Cotter was that once Bandora Dam had been built and Corran, water could come to Canberra by gravity, because we no longer had to pump it uphill from the old Cotter Dam via the Cotter pumping station, and a gravity main was built from Bandora to channel the water down by gravity. And of course today we'd look at that and say, well, that makes good environmental sense, doesn't it, so that you can avoid using thermally driven electrical pumps. But of course it wasn't done for environmental reasons back in the 60s. It was done for cost, because it was costing too much to run the Cotter pumping station. But nonetheless, it had a good environmental plus. Of course, this period of development in the 40s, 50s and 60s is rather remote from our own time now, because that was a period marked by a very strong pro-development ethos in Australia. Now, we tend to view these projects through the prism of the Franklin Dam campaign. And rather than everyone immediately agreeing to these sorts of major projects, we tend to step back and think, well, what are the natural values that might be being lost? We've seen that here with the unrest about the proposed Tennant Dam. We've seen it in Queensland with the Mary River Dam. So there's been a fundamental change in people's regard to that sort of development. And so in that way, you know, we look back to these developments on the Cotter as a rather distinctive period. But the thing that hasn't changed is that the mountains are still our primary supply of water, whether it's the Cotter, I mean the Googong system, the Queanbeyan River, it starts in mountainous country to the southeast, and now we're drawing water from the Murrumbidgee, which of course starts up in Kosciuszko National Park and is also a mountain-fed stream. I'd like now to play for you a second tape for tonight, and this is Graham Kelleher, who was the Department of Works chief engineer on the Corran project. And we tend to think of, you know, big blokes and big machines. Well, that's exactly the sort of impression that comes across in this extract, which gives a different light to the sort of things that go on when you're building an earthen rock fill dam.
And I guess the most serious argument we had was about an event that occurred on the main embankment, when we had a particular work supervisor there watching the placement of earthen rock fill and the filter material, and he insisted that the surface rock on the face of the rock fill was of a particular quality and size, to a degree that the guys doing the work felt that he was excessive, and when it wasn't right, he'd tell them to replace the material and so forth, which they hated. And I saw from the site office this dozer, I think it was a D8, swing around when he was standing on the embankment and just miss his head with the dozer blade by a fraction of a foot. And it looked to me very deliberate. And the guy just had an argument with the supervisor. So that's one thing that you couldn't tolerate at all. So I checked with one of my contacts, an officer, an officer of works, told him the trouble and said I was going to issue an instruction that this guy should be removed from the site. So there was a tremendous commotion about that, and there was enormous pressure put on me, not just by the contractor, but by the union and the Department of Works, to resolve from that position. But I refused to resolve from that position. There was the talks of the strike, all sorts of things went on. So, I mean, the position I had was that the guy could not drive a dozer on the site. Again, I mean, if they want to employ him in some other situation where he wouldn't have a weapon like a dozer under his control, that'll be a different matter. And finally that was resolved without a tremendous strike, but it was a very, very dicey time, very stressful for everyone concerned.
So the concept of bulldozer as a weapon is a rather novel one. So just the final theme, skiing. You know, skiing was a very different time of year because traditionally people, whether Indigenous or non-Indigenous, had always gone away from the mountains in winter. You know, they were a horrible place, all that cold, wet snow stuff. But once people started to ski, they thought, well, maybe winter does have something to offer. And, of course, we made our first faltering steps on skis back at Kyandra in the 1860s. And that pioneering period, I think, really extends right up until the late 1950s because it's only then that we get the resort boom and the modern developments that led to skiing as we know it today. And so the story of ACT skiing, which is essentially the story of Mount Franklin Chalet, it belongs in that pioneering period. So the chalet developed in the 1930s and active as a ski lodge through to, say, the 1970s or so. It was marked by, as was skiing in so many places of the Australian High Country during that time, difficult access, rudimentary accommodation. You made your own ski runs through the trees and you often made your own skis, and there were hardly any ski lifts except those that you might be able to make your own. And, of course, it's a huge contrast to the modern mega resorts. If you go up to Mount Franklin Chalet, or Mount Franklin today, of course, the chalet disappeared in the bushfires, but up on the top of Mount Franklin is still the Austin A40 motor vehicle installed in 1965 to drive one of the two rope tows they had on the mountain. And you couldn't find a stronger contrast between that rusting car body and the mega resorts of, you know, Perisher Blue and Threadbow and Falls Creek, where you can get as many lifts, lift rides in a day as you like, but you have to be able to pay for it, and it's almost $100 a day for a lift ticket. So the whole approach to skiing was very different in those days. You know, the current, it's been going for several decades, where there were two streams of skiing. You either skied downhill on the resort slopes or you went cross-country with different sorts of gear. Well, back in the early period, everyone essentially had the same sort of gear, which enabled you to do the both. So by the time of the bushfires, Franklin was the oldest club-built ski lodge on the Australian mainland and had a very significant story to tell. And accompanying it on nearby Mount Janini was the RNC Duntroon Ski Lodge too, which had some interesting aspects to its story. It was quite a novel way for military cadets, army officers of the future to spend their recreational time, maybe develop some leadership qualities and an experience with snow. So they're the main themes I wanted to talk about. And just to close the formal part of the talk before we put on a video, just a few comments about oral history. There's about 130 or so people listed in the bibliography of the book as having agreed to interviews. And since I started on this work, nearly half of those people have passed away. So I think more than anything, that shows why this sort of work should be done, so that these stories can be recorded, as you've heard tonight. Graham is still with us, luckily. He went on to become the chairman of the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, and he wrote the first ever environmental impact statement for an Australian dam, and that was Googong in the 1970s, so quite a significant individual. But a couple of other things about oral history. You know, you always have to try to corroborate your stories where possible, because is the person leading you on, or you know, do they have a subjective memory, or have they forgotten half the story? So, for example, when I was interviewing Ted Kennedy about the building of Bagg Range Fire Tower in the Brindabellas, he said that one of the reasons it was built was because it was wartime, Second World War, and there was a lot of fear about the Japanese dropping incendiary bombs and starting bushfires. And when I heard that, I thought, you know, it sounds a bit far-fetched to me. I didn't say that, of course, but later, when I went and saw David Wardle and his excellent people at ACT Archives and started going through the files of the Bushfire Council, sure enough, there it all was. Even the Prime Minister was concerned about the dropping of incendiaries deliberately to start bushfires, and that was a fantastic revelation. And Ted, you know, I'm sorry that I doubt it, because you were right. So, you know, healthy scepticism is all very well, but don't let it take you too far. A second example, Huey Reid was a wonderful character from out at Nace, and he told me about a local man who was hit by a train at a level crossing sometime in the late 19th century and got carried on the front of that train all the way into Queanbeyan. And I knew that Huey sometimes stretched the truth. He had great stories, and so I put that in the possibly far-out sort of basket. Well, when I was going through the George de Salis diaries at the National Library, sure enough, the man's name was Con Grady, and he was hit by the train on the 10th of March 1888. He was carried in a sitting position on the front of that train all the way into Queanbeyan, dead. And, you know, it, once again, you find corroboration for this story, which at first seems, you know, a bit far out. So as Fox Mulder used to say, the truth is out there. So with that, I might refer to our video tonight, and this is a film which I've watched heaps of times, but I never tire of it. And we're going to learn about the conservation of a slab homestead in the mountains. This is a film called Timbercraft, and it's about the conservation of Coolamine Homestead over in Kosciuszko, which of these places that are linked to the ACT because of the early grazing history, this is one of the most significant because it has that strong relationship. This film was made by Film Australia in the 1980s. It was one of the first over-the-shoulder documentaries. Now, we've got used to that technique now. It's where you don't see the interviewer. It's as if you're there watching the interviewees all the time. Now, that's pretty common now, but this was one of the first times that had been done, and this film actually won an award in its time. So this is a look at the conservation of a traditional building in the high country, a slab building using traditional woodworking methods. I'm glad you enjoyed it as much as I do. And, of course, these sorts of projects not only keep those buildings alive, but they keep the skills alive as well. And although that project was run by the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service, to their credit, it's a volunteer group called the Kosciuszko Huts Association, which does a lot of this sort of work, and it's almost 40 years old now, working with the New South Wales and ACT Park Services to bring buildings back from the grave, like that one. And, the masterly use of hand tools, Bill Boyd, you know, slicing paper-thin slivers of... And anyone who's ever handled a broad axe or any of those tools, you know, it's... I tried it once and it was hopeless. It's a lifetime of learning to really become a master craftsman like that, and it's really fantastic that Film Australia and the Australian Heritage Commission particularly had the foresight to have that film made when that project was underway. And unlike the timber skis from Mount Franklin that I referred to at the beginning of the talk, Coolamine Homestead did survive the 03 fires. It's still there, and even as we speak, there's more conservation work going on because the job is never fully done. You have to redo it a few years later. So just to finish, I guess I'd like to say that I mentioned that a lot of the work involved in this sort of research and writing involves physical field work, getting out there in the boots or the skis and having a great time. But just as the book is called Rugged Beyond Imagination, I'd have to be honest and say that at the end of some of these trips, I've been buggered beyond imagination too. So thanks very much for coming this evening.
Thanks so much, Matthew. That was just a brilliant perspective on our high country. And don't forget, guys, the book's on sale in June.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.